Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves. And we have a really fun guest today. This is Denise Flame. Denise is a breeder and judge of Rhodesian Ridgebacks. She's also a magazine publisher and an editor, historian for the breed, book publisher. So welcome, Denise. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
Same here, Laura.
So we're talking about today Rhodesian Ridgebacks, right? And the National's coming up October.
First week in October.
Right. And so it just seemed like a perfect time to get to talk about a breed that I think is stunning and often maybe not very well understood.
Prospective judges tell me all the time that they find Ridgebacks to be a hard breed to get. And on the one hand, that seems odd because this is a very basic breed. It's the template for, you know, dog with a capital D. There's no extra frippery. You know, the breed wasn't developed by a bunch of Victorians sipping tea and eating cucumber sandwiches. It was a breed that had to function in southern Africa. It had to endurance trot. Of course, very big and oftentimes dangerous game. It's a very functional breed, but there's a lot of confusion about what is a correct Ridgeback, and I think that has to do with the number of styles that we have within type.
Correct. And I would say I completely agree with that. I've shown the breed for 20 some odd years, and I've had it described to me by the mentor of this and that and the other style, and those are not the same. It's interesting.
I think of it as a Goldilocks breed, right?
Yes.
You don't want Papa Bear's porridge because it's too hot. You don't want Mama Bear's porridge because it's too cold. You want Baby Bear's porridge. You want the perfect middle ground. And the standard has a wonderful phrase under the description of gait, but it applies to the breed as a whole, which is the perfect balance between power and elegance. And in the Ridgeback, you have the constant tension between two polar opposites. And you can think about it a bunch of different ways, between speed and strength, between the sighthound influences in the breed, which are quite strong, as well as
right.
the working, or I like to think of it as the Great Dane influence in the breed, because there were some interesting genetic studies done last year that looked at how different breeds were related and what breeds clustered together. And interestingly, the Ridgeback clustered strongly with only one other breed, and that is the Great Dane. And that's where we get our bone and size from, as do the Irish Wolfhounds, for example, which is a different breed, but similar in Irish Wolfhounds, too. You want a dog that is heavy enough to bring down a wolf, but lithe and fast enough to catch it.
Yeah.
So in the Ridgeback, you want that perfect middle ground between these opposing forces. And it's really hard in the ring and in the whelping box to achieve that. So as a judge and as a breeder, you are forced sometimes to point or accept a little bit in either direction. But once you understand what that perfect balance is and when it walks in the ring, if you can find that, you're fine, and then you just sort of move off of that in either direction if you don't have exactly that perfect balance. So sometimes you might put up a dog that's a little bit heavier than you would like, but certainly not a mastiff. Or you might put up something that's a little more of a running look, a little bit fightier than you would want, but certainly you're not a ham sandwich away from being a Saluki.
I think that it is a fascinating breed, and I think that the diversity of style is definitely something that I see in the ring showing the dogs. And I would love to talk a little bit more about, as you mentioned, your National Club historian. I would love to talk more about the history of the breed, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions, maybe.
It really befuddles me when judges, prospective judges, and even seminar presenters say, oh, I hate doing this history stuff. Because to me, if you don't understand the history of a breed, you're doomed because you can't understand its function and its morphology.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's pretty basic.
That just makes me crazy.
Yeah. Well, the Dutch, when they went to southern Africa in the 1600s, found this sort of unimproved border collie looking dog. They were very unappealing by all historical accounts. mouse gray dog that hung around with the native Khoi Khoi people there, and it had this dorsal rise of hair on its back. And the Dutch brought with them various continental breeds, and they were crossed with this dog, and the oral history tells us that the resulting dogs had a little more native knowledge, were a little more resistant to things like the tsetse fly, etc. And then the Boers, as the Dutch were called in that part of the world, moved north to Rhodesia. And in the late 1800s, a big game hunter named Cornelius van Rooyen got a couple of ridged bitches. They were described as greyhound-like bitches, and interbred them in his pack, and he found that the resulting offspring were excellent at lion hunting. And this is where the lion hunting myth for the breed kind of comes up. And judges always say, well, yes, I put up that ridgeback because it was big enough to take down the lion. You know, any ridgeback foolhardy enough to try to make contact with the lion soon exits the gene pool in an unceremonious fashion.
Exactly.
So the whole lion hunting myth, van Rooyen was quite successful, and he would go out on these big treks. He was also a procurer of zoo animals for many European zoos, and the ridgebacks were required to trot alongside his oxen-drawn carts for all day. So you needed a breed that was built correctly, that could endurance trot, that could break off and course some game for the pot, whether it's an antelope or whatnot, at night, that could protect the encampment and at the homesteads, the family, from predators, human or otherwise. And so generally what you have is an all-purpose dog, a jack-of-all-trades, master of none. And that's the Ridgeback. So there's a wonderful Swedish breeder judge named Stig Carlson who said in his book about the Ridgeback that the only extreme thing about a Ridgeback is the absolute lack of extremes. And that really does sum up the breed. It's a breed that is just of a piece, looks like flat muscle, the ultimate athlete, looking like it could be carved out of marble. The lion hunting piece, what people need to know, is that the Ridgeback was used to bay when they were used to go out on hunts with wealthy Europeans, which is the market for that, for the lion hunting. They would, in small packs of two or three, find the lion and harass it. A metaphor that was used was sort of like a matador. You know, the one Ridgeback would dart in, annoy the lion. It would whip around, the Ridgeback would dart back out. Another Ridgeback would come in from the opposite side. Bitches were used often because they were faster. This is something to keep in mind when we start talking about size. As with many breeds uniformly, Ridgebacks are oversized in the ring. The top of the standard for males is 27 inches. If you see a 27-inch male Ridgeback in the ring, oftentimes he will appear small. Bottom of the standard for a bitch is 24 inches. Very rarely see a 24-inch bitch in the ring, and again, she'll appear infinitesimally small. But it's important to remember that. So you need good rears with strong hocks because they're pivoting, very strong, short hocks so they can pivot on that, and just an overall athleticism that lets them get in, out of the way of those slashing claws.
Right. And I think that that's important for people to understand and think of more in terms of some of the hounds that we see in this country that were developed for cougar hunting and coon hunting and some of that more lithe and racy than people necessarily are thinking of always when they think of the Ridgeback.
Well, and also, if you think about sighthounds or sighthound-derived breeds, the size and the bone of the dog always parallels the game that it hunted. This is why Irish wolfhounds look as they do, and this is why whippets look as they do. So if you think about antelope and large ungulates in Africa, they can be 200 pounds. So you need enough bone. But again, going back to the Irish wolfhound, enough bone to bring it down, but you've got to be able to catch it first.
Right. Absolutely fascinating. And this is another, I'm using you to just poke holes in all my favorite ones that I've heard over the years. I had someone else, and I think it has some comparison, but you can help me out with that. Somebody I heard said, paint a Dalmatian red, and I've heard yes and I've heard no. Thoughts?
Okay, so that comes from the fact that the Ridgeback standard, which was written in 1922, was poached from the Dalmatian standard of the period.
Interesting. Now that is brand new. I had no idea.
Yeah, there was a meeting very famously held in the 20s where all the lion dog, at the time the breed was not called the Ridgeback, it was called the African lion dog. And they brought all their lion dogs and they lined them up. And that lineup, according to the description of someone who was at that meeting, ranged from a Great Dane style dog to a bull terrier style dog. The type was all over the board. So they did a buffet approach. I like this head. I like that thorax. I like this size. And they wrote a standard for a breed. At the time in the 20s, in South Africa, when you think Kruger Park was founded in the late 1890s, big game hunting had already departed. And in Rhodesia, it was starting to wane. So the breed and its function was starting to almost become extinct. So they created, out of all these different styles and types of dog, this template for the Ridgeback. And the Dalmatian standard was very useful because it was an endurance trotting breed. It had two nose colors, as does the Ridgeback, black and brown, which we also call liver. And if you take a Dalmatian and you add about 20% more size, you adjust its conformation for a running dog, so the croup area, you know, you get a little more slope to the croup, and you paint it red, you have a Ridgeback.
Okay. Interesting. Love this. See, this is my geek out type of stuff. I love the history and those little details. I think that is so important.
And that shouldn't be geeky. That should be part of your preparation. I went to, when I was getting ready to apply for Borzoi, I went to a very well-known Borzoi kennel, and I was armed with a list of questions about the standard, and I spent 4 hours. The breeder was very gracious, and I got to see all these wonderful Borzoi. And when the breeder filled out my form, the last line said, takes a delightfully old-fashioned approach to learning about the breed. And I don't think learning about the history of a breed or asking about its standard is delightfully old-fashioned. I think it's fundamental.
Yeah, fundamental. I agree. But this is the part I love. So let's go to now. We were talking about nose color. And I think that's super important. And also kind of that range of coat color and white markings and some of those things that, again, are detail oriented, but that I think a lot of people miss.
So Ridgebacks have two nose colors, black and brown, and they are equally correct, and the standard does not prefer one over the other, and judges are required to judge them accordingly. You can have a preference, and that's very nice, so when you go out and buy a Ridgeback and you prefer black noses, then you can go get yourself a black nose Ridgeback. But when you're a judge in the ring, the best Ridgeback in the ring has a brown nose. You'd best point to it. And I've heard judges say, I don't like that color, I won't put it up. They ought not to be judging our breed. Similarly, we have a range of color. Ridgebacks are wheaten. Wheaten is an agouti pattern. If you look at an individual Ridgeback hair, it's banded, light and dark colors in there. That's what gives the coat its warmth, and that's what gives it its life, if you will. If you think about wheat isn't just one color. It's a range of color. So you can have a field of wheat that's ripe and ready for harvest, and it'll be that rich red, but you can have a field of wheat that's still not mature, and that is a golden flaxen color. That's the range of color in the Ridgeback. What's important is that it has that warmth of the sun, whether it's a lighter shade or a dark shade. The light wheaten, there are probably only three places left on the planet where you can find those dogs in any number here in the United States, in the UK, and in Scandinavia. Everywhere else in the world, they've developed this deep red Ridgeback fascination, to the point where they're pushing the coat color to a muddy, mahogany Irish Setter red, which is wrong. It may be flashy, but it's incorrect. So to me, I think light wheaten dogs, and I don't breed or judge, to me there's nothing more gorgeous than a light wheaten dog with a beautiful, correct, dark pigment if it's the black nose and a beautiful, round, dark eye. But the stereotype for the Ridgeback among pet people, and also sadly among some judges, is a big, oversized, bucket-headed, black-nosed, black-masked, deep red male. And there's far more to the breed than that.
Right. And I think that that is a confusion amongst breeders. You know, people that see it being shown in South Africa and it's mahogany red, well, that should be the color they should be, right?
Although, you know, if you look at the dogs being shown in South Africa, there's so much sharing of bloodline internationally now that you can't really go to the country of origin and expect to find only African bred dogs. There's a lot of American and European blood there now. I think it's just a matter of fashion, and standards have nothing to do with fashion. They have to do with function. And so that wheaten coat, the breed did have many colors initially. We had brindles at one point. We had fawns, solid colors, and sables. And by the 1940s, we whittled it down a bit. So now Wheaton is quite a large spectrum, and we just asked judges that they focus on conformation of the dog. Our standard, a lot's very small. We still have a scale of points in the Ridgeback standard, and I think only 2.5 points are allotted to coat and color.
Not the most important thing.
And you mentioned white.
Yes.
So the Ridgeback standard says a little white on the chest and on the toes is fine. You'll find that here in the United States, breeders are much more concerned about the structure of the dog and the type, and a little bit of white creeping up to the pastern isn't going to bother anybody. That's not the case overseas. Overseas in Europe and Australia, they insist on a perfect ridge and a minimal, ideally no white. And I think that our attitude here is correct. Certainly we don't want white up to the elbow. We don't want so much white that it's going to detract. But if there's a little extra paint on an otherwise sound and typey dog, I don't think anyone is going to criticize a judge's decision. A little white that goes in a ribbon up the neck, as long as it's not excessive and the first thing you see, it, generally speaking, most Ridgeback folks don't have a problem with that.
All right, very good. Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute.
How much is that dog in the window?
Okay, crew. I hear it pretty much every day now. I love pure dog talk. And that makes my heart happy, because I love doing it. I started hosting Pure Dog Talk as a way to reach out to members of our community with education and resources to enable you to succeed and move forward in your goals and ambitions. And your response has been literally overwhelming. The podcast has been downloaded well over 250,000 times to date. That's incredible. All of this information is free to exhibitors around the world at the touch of a button. But here's the reality check. Money really does make the world go round, guys. So I created a special patrons group. This funding source helps cover the expenses of audio editing and website hosting and technology and like that. Patrons keep Pure Dog Talk's fountain of knowledge flowing freely. And like the NPR of dogdom, our patrons support Pure Dog Talk with monthly gifts. We even offer advertising and sponsorship opportunities that you guys may not have known about. So drop me a note, laura@puredogtalk.com, and I'll let you know how you can help share the love.
You were just talking about ridges, obviously the hallmark of the breed. And again, something that I think is not extraordinarily well understood, although somewhat more so than some of the other pieces.
So the ridge for the Ridgeback is the hallmark of the breed. A lot of people, are judges in particular, are mystified by it because it's something that other breeds don't have. They want to look at it up close. It's simply a stripe of backward growing hair. And in the Ridgeback, it starts at the shoulder, it goes to the prominence of the hip, it tapers, and in the upper one-third of the ridge, there are two whorls or swirls of hair. That's it. You don't want more than two. You don't want less than two. That's a serious fault. And you want those two whorls to be more or less opposite one another. The standard says perfectly symmetrical. Arguably, if a Ridgeback comes in my ring and those two little swirls are offset by a quarter inch, I'm not going to sweat it. As one of my mentors said to me, and this is true, it takes no skill to breed a good ridge. It's the dog underneath that's the challenge. So the Parent Club does a great job of showing in the elaborated standard acceptable ridges. They may not be ideal, but they're acceptable. You just want one that's long enough with those two crowns, more or less, opposite one another.
And I would think of it in the ways that we think of our bird dogs. You know, we don't wire hair pointers. They don't run on their heads, right? They don't run on their ridges.
Right. But it is an important trait. And right now, the FCI is contemplating creating a ridgeless variety, which is... Yeah, it's funny. But, you know, it makes... For all the complaining we do about the American Kennel Club, our parent clubs control their standards.
Right.
And no one is going to parachute in with arguably very little breed-specific knowledge and tell you, you gotta do this.
Oh, my God.
So we ought to be very thankful about the autonomy that we as breed clubs and as guardians of our breeds have, because, you know, this could happen. The ridge is important because nothing exists in nature if it's not functional. You know, nature doesn't perpetuate a trait if it doesn't have some sort of a function. And in ridgebacks, we're told that that ridge, the dogs that carried it were superlative hunters and could survive in the off-harsh environment of southern Africa. I have a Danish friend who did some Peace Corps type work in Africa, and in the bush she encountered a family. They had never seen anyone outside of their tribal group. She was the first white person they had ever seen. They had a litter of puppies. The ridged puppies were kept inside their dwelling, and the rest were kept outside. And it was explained to her that they were considered more valuable because they were better hunters, and so they were cared for better. You have to think that with that ridge, which is the dominant trait, and there are a lot of ridged animals in Africa. If you go look at lion taxidermy, they have ridges too, not on their back, but oftentimes on their sides or on their flanks, with whorling and swirls like ridgebacks do, and a lot of the antelopes in Africa do. So it's a trait that exists in it, and nature doesn't, you know, she's not capricious. Nature is very, if something doesn't work, it soon exits your gene pool. And who knows what kind of native knowledge or traits travel with that.
Right.
For example, if you have a ridgeback, ridgebacks do not jump into pools of standing water. If you have a swimming pool and your ridgeback jumps in, it will be once, and that's it. They don't jump. They like a graded entrance into the water. Because if you're a ridgeback in southern Africa and you jump into a pool of standing water, you may not come out because there's usually something there that's looking for
a snack,
an appetizer, right? Is this connected? Who knows? But things like this that at the end give you the essence of your breed, all the things about it that you love, seen and unseen, I think that it's far more complex than we know, and that just adds to the really interesting study of these breeds.
I love that. Okay, so here's another one that I think I want to get to your line about the things in the standard that the judges get wrong, but I also think that we need to have 2 minutes of temperament and proper ridgeback temperament and how important that is.
Right. So ridgebacks are not sporting dogs, right? They're hounds. So hounds are bred to hunt independently. As a result, there's a degree of independence and a degree of autonomy that these dogs have. So if a ridgeback doesn't want to do something, you are not going to convince it through your authority as the handler or owner or brute force to do it. The ridgeback has to agree to do it with you. In the show ring, if they don't know what's going on, if they haven't been properly socialized, if they haven't been properly trained, and someone goes to go over them and starts messing in their mouth, they might resist. That's not condoning bad temperament. That's acknowledging the intelligence of the breed and making sure that you've got a dog that's ready to be shown and understands the game. And judges who encounter puppies that are a little unsure should be gentle and should treat them the way they would any other sighthound or sighthound-derived breed. The Ridgeback is, and I chaired the parent club committee when the realignment of the groups was happening.
Oh, right.
And we pulled our membership, and I pulled together the historical documentation. Undeniably, the Ridgeback is based on sighthound blood. There's strong greyhound foundation there. And you would expect those breeds are sensitive to their surroundings, and they just don't accept or capitulate. And the Ridgeback's the same way. That said, Ridgeback should not be seeing dead people.
Yeah.
A mature dog in the ring should be able to, you know, stand and be gone over. They might move a leg. They might tuck their tail because they don't like it, but it shouldn't be a wrestling match. However, if there's a stripe of tape when the dog is gating and the dog jumps it,
yeah, leaves, leaves, jumping over the leaves. I can remember one bitch in the
pond. Yeah. Or if something happens, there's a loud noise, they're going to stop. And it might take a little bit of time for them to settle, because when you come from southern Africa, which is really a quiet place, and something happens that's loud, it usually isn't good. So when these dogs' instincts kick in, this is just sort of judging 101. Judges should know that when a dog startles like that, put it to the end of the line, give it a minute to recover.
Right. Absolutely. And then let's close out with, what do judges miss? What do they misunderstand in the standard? What do they miss when they're looking at a ring full of dogs?
The Ridgeback standard, the AKC standard, is second only to the Canadian one, which has never, ever been revised since it was, I think, put in place in the 40s. is pretty close to the standard from the 1940s, which is the first modern Ridgeback standard. And the senior breeders that were on the committees that revised the standard twice were really respectful of the language of the standard. The problem is that modern fanciers and judges don't take the time to look up words. Can I tell you how many judges have said to me that the standard says that the head should be free from wrinkle when in repose? I think you ought to get a dictionary and look up repose. But if you don't have one, let me tell you that repose means at rest. This means that a Ridgeback head should not have wrinkles except when the dog alerts and then you see some furrowing on the forehead.
Right.
I am of the school that says that we should not rewrite our standards and dumb it down so that people could understand it better. I think those people that want to know the standard and know the breed ought to read the standard, and if there's something they're unsure of or a word that's foreign, look it up.
Repose should not be a foreign word. Sorry.
Repose should not be. It's in other standards, too. I've looked. And this inspired me to do a book project, as you mentioned, book publisher. And I'm working on a book now called Take Note of the Standards, and I'm starting with the hound standards. And every breed, Pat Trotter has done elk hounds, Dan Marbolti has done Basenjis and so forth. And it literally takes the standard and has them highlight phrases or portions of it that people often misinterpret or get wrong, and gives little notes in the margins to amplify it. Because I think we need that. Rather than changing the standard, we ought to change the way we read the standard. So I'll give you an example from the Ridgeback standard. The Ridgeback standard, when it talks about the eye, says the color of the eye should harmonize with the color of the dog. The color of the dog is not the color of the coat. The color of the dog is the pigment of the dog. So a dog with a black nose has a dark eye. A dog with a brown nose has an amber eye. The Canadian standard changed it, harmonizing to the color of the nose. Maybe in this instance we ought to change it to something. The FCI standard has changed that to the color of the eye should harmonize with the color of the coat. They got it wrong. So if you're judging in an FCI country with that standard, you're going to be saying, oh, well, that dog has a light coat, so it can have a glaring yellow flashbulb eye. No.
No.
Black nose, dark eye. Brown nose, amber eye. Brown nose dogs can't have dark chocolate, almost black eyes, because they don't have pigment. They can have a dark amber eye because they only have brown pigment.
So we didn't do this. We didn't go into the where and how and why of the pigment differences.
In terms of the historical...
Yeah. I'm back to my geek out, okay? Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. I think, as with many things in dogs, that was arbitrary. You know, we had a lot of colors. Mm. Why didn't Brindle make it? You know, Brindle made it up until the 40s.
Right.
Then they dropped them. There was, as I understand, a group of breeders in northern Rhodesia that had brown-nosed dogs, and they lobbied rather successfully, and it stayed in the standard. The brown-nosed dogs are less numerous than the black because brown is a recessive. It's a simple autosomal recessive. When you breed two brown-nosed dogs together, Genetics 101, another pet peeve of mine, I was asked by a Ridgeback breeder, and I use that term loosely, what would happen if he bred two brown noses together? And the answer is... you'll get a litter of brown noses. You can't get black out of brown. Because brown noses are not quite as popular, I think also we really love that as a species, human beings, love that dark, soft, expressive dark eye, which goes with the black nose. The amber eyes are equally as beautiful. It's just a different, you know, it's like olives. You have to acquire a taste for it. It's going to be a slightly different expression, but you just have to become accustomed
to it. Absolutely. Okay, so we're going to sum up Rhodesian Ridgebacks. They walk in just that. What's your go-to?
They walk in, and you're looking for a smooth dog with an unbroken fluid line from the top of the head, lovely crested neck, smooth withers, straight top line, gently sloped croup, an underline that's not as excessive as a sighthound, but certainly not tubular or straight across. You're looking for a dog that's slightly longer than tall, that's not oversized, that's a handy size for hunting, and a dog that looks like it could do its job, trot all day. All the basics, well-angled front assembly, matching rear assembly that's strong, not overdone, not weak, not high-hocked, good thorax, deep long, good heart and lung room because you need a dog that's going to endure, not an empty front, a little bit of prosternum, short loin, and a dog that moves freely, effortlessly, like it could run all day. And a lovely head with a great big round dark eye, as dark as each nose color permits, with lovely triangular ears that flare and frame the face, not pendulous, which gives a beautiful flared triangular ear that's not short because that gives a fighting dog look, and we don't want that. We wanted just a beautiful, lovely head with good underjaw. And there you have it, your package.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you so much, Denise. And we will have you back again, and we will talk about some of our Molosser breeds, which I think will be a totally fun time, too.
Would love to.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Laura.
All right, crew, we are back with Allison Foley from the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. Welcome, Allison.
Hi, Laura. How's it going today?
Awesome. I'm just going to go with awesome. It's a beautiful sunshiny day here in Southern Oregon. How about you, babe?
Yep, bright and sunny here.
Excellent. So we are talking today about using cornstarch for those awful dematting situations we see.
Right. So, you know, Poodle University, I have a lot of poodles, a lot of poodle people, a lot of poodles going through coat changes and matting, a lot of poodles getting stuck in branches and brambles and burrs and you name it. But of course, this would work on any dog. And there's all kinds of different products out there for dematting. And you know what? Most of them are like really, really fabulous. Love them. But maybe it's Sunday night and you realize that you have an early deadline tomorrow and your dog has a matted ear and you don't have any dematting spray. Or maybe you're at the cottage or at a friend's house for the weekend or something and your dog's matted or got into some burrs or some bramble. And you know what? Good old-fashioned cornstarch, you sprinkle it in there and it really will help to loosen that mat up and get the matting out of there. Clearly, you're going to use a pin brush with it. And it also, I just used it on a dog that got into some burrs and it really helped slick the burrs out. It's that just the cornstarch going there and it just really helps get them out. And apparently they've been using it for a long, long time. Like back before we had dematting products, that's what was used to demat these double coated breeds and to get burrs and thistles out of them.
Yeah.
So the next time you're stuck somewhere and you're like, oh no, I'm out of this or I'm out of that or I'm at a friend's house. Even if there's no cornstarch in the house, it's 99 cents down at the local grocery store, right? Anybody can get out to the grocery store. So yeah, that's a new one for me too. But I was pleasantly surprised at how well it works. So give it a try out there.
I love it. Growing up as a little kid, we had Clumber Spaniels. And the only thing actually, we didn't have a tack box, right? Like we were so redneck backwards. We had like a denim purse. The only thing in it was a pair of thinning shears and a box of cornstarch and a couple leashes and a brush. And that was it.
There you go. That's all you need.
All right, Allison. Thank you so much. Listeners, always remember Pure Dog Talk 25. That is your checkout code when you go to take in any of Allison's courses or sign up for a subscription for the fabulous Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. So thank you, Allison.
Thank you, Laura. Have a great day.
The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our Dog Show Superintendents are the hardworking people who make the Dog Show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the Supers desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.